Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for November 21st, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, classifying native and non-native plant species in the Galapagos, DNA sequencing 30,000 times faster, and a science careers feature on being a financial analyst, or, as it's known on Wall Street, a quant. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
About 1,000 kilometers off the coast of Ecuador, the Galapagos Islands represent the diversity of life, thanks in part to Charles Darwin and his book, The Origin of Species. Conserving that diversity means knowing what is native to the volcanic islands and what was brought there by people. In a paper in this week's Science, Cynthia Freud and colleagues report that 6 plant species that had been considered non-native are indeed native. The team found fossilized pollen that dates back thousands of years before people were believed to have arrived at the islands. I spoke with Freud from her office at Oxford University.
What this project is part of is an overall project where we wanted to directly apply paleo-environmental information to practical conservation issues in Galapagos. So one of the primary applications being an assessment of the ecological conditions and processes which existed in Galapagos prior to human impact, in order to use this really as an ecological baseline for designing appropriate restoration programs. And one of the issues we were particularly interested in was this idea of these so-called doubtful native species. These are species whose provenance was unknown, whether they were introduced and should therefore potentially be eradicated from Galapagos during restoration programs, or whether they're actually native.
So how did your team determine whether these plant species had been in the Galapagos before people got to the islands?
Well, what we did is we took sediment cores. So there's these really unique sphagnum bogs, so moss bogs that are up in the highlands in volcanic craters of Santa Cruz Island in the center of the Galapagos Archipelago. And we core down into these sediments. And then what we can do is radiocarbon date the sediments to establish how old they are. And then from that, extract fossil pollen. From that, we can then look at the fossil pollen species we see and reconstruct what was present there thousands of years ago.
So how far back do these pollen date? How far back did you look, and when did people first come to the Galapagos?
Right, well, we looked at 4 different sites, and the oldest one dated back to 8,200 years ago, the younger one to 1,200 years ago. And people first arrived in Galapagos, we believe, just with European contact, so in 1535.
And the data is pretty convincing that these pollen were around before then?
Absolutely. I mean, we see them thousands of years, you know, in some cases, 8,200 years. So that's well before the arrival of humans or any potential arrival of humans.
And these fossilized pollen, if they were viable today, would yield the same plant species that are on the island?
I mean, they're not viable, obviously, but they are. The time frames we're looking at are the same species involved. So the fossil pollen we see is the same as what you see in modern pollen. Yes.
So they didn't meaningfully evolve or hybridize in those thousands of years?
No, not within the time period that we're looking at.
So what was thought then to be a non-native species is just reclaiming its habitat?
That's right. So these species had been identified originally at some point in a Galapagos flora, identified as non-native, so introduced to the islands. But then conservationists, for a number of different reasons, for about 60 species in Galapagos, began to question whether or not they were actually native to the archipelago. Of course, with just modern ecological techniques, it's using a bit of conjecture to try to decide whether they're native or not. So we then could use the fossil pollen to look back and see that at least 6 of these species that we found were native to the archipelago.
What implications does this have for conservation in the Galapagos?
Well, I think it really has implications for just how you design your restoration program. So at least for these 6 species, we now know that they're native. So you wouldn't want to then be, you know, obviously proposing any eradication of these species. And potentially, you could actually then design conservation programs which would enhance these species if that's what was desired.
How about beyond the Galapagos? Could this method for determining the native or non-native status of plants be applied elsewhere?
Yes, definitely. And this sort of work is particularly well designed for working in oceanic islands, places where you have sort of less biodiverse regions, because then you can begin in the pollen record to get down to species level. And there are larger implications for this work, just that many of these species have been identified as introduced or invasive throughout Pacific islands, and more than likely, a number of them could be native to other island ecosystems as well.
Cynthia Freud, thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much for your interest.
Cynthia Freud is corresponding author of a paper on using fossilized pollen as a guide to conservation in the Galapagos. Read the paper in this week's Science. Last week, the Obama-Biden team revealed further details on the transition process, including a list of the review teams organized to make policy, budgetary, and personnel decisions about federal agencies before the inauguration. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
On that list is Tom Khalil at the University of California, Berkeley, and Mario Molina at the University of California, San Diego. Khalil has been developing new multidisciplinary research and education initiatives. Molina is a physical chemist who won the 1995 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his role in elucidating the effects of chlorofluorocarbons on the Earth's ozone layer. The pair are leading the group for the review of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Additionally, there is Tom Wheeler, who has taken a leave of absence as a managing director at the technology venture capital firm Core Capital Partners. He is leading the team evaluating science, technology, space, and art agencies. Meanwhile, speculation continues about what the policies of the Obama administration might be in science and technology. One issue that may get an early look in 2009 is stem cell research. During the campaign, Obama pledged to overturn President Bush's stem cell policy, which restricts the number of human embryonic stem cell lines eligible for federally funded research. When it comes to research funding, Obama has signaled his interest in boosting the budgets of major federal research agencies such as the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. But following through could be tricky in the current economic environment. Obama has also cited energy as one of the top concerns of his upcoming administration, but how he decides to balance the issue with his other priorities remains to be seen.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. For more information on the transition, visit election2008.aaas.org. It took over a decade and billions of dollars to sequence the human genome the first time, a project completed in 2003. Since then, scientists have developed many new technologies to cut costs and speed up the process, and now, in a paper published online by Science, Jonas Korlach, Steve Turner, and colleagues describe their team's DNA sequencing method that they estimate is 30,000 times faster than current processes, reducing the time it would take to sequence the entire human genome to about 1 hour. I spoke with Korlach and Turner from their offices at Pacific Biosciences in Menlo Park, California. Here's Steve Turner.
This is a new sequencing technology, and this paper represents the proof of principle of its operation. It's basically a method of watching a DNA polymerase molecule as it undergoes template-directed synthesis, observing the identity of each nucleotide in real time as it is incorporated by a DNA polymerase molecule.
Jonas?
What I'd like to add is that one of the hallmarks of this technology also is that it's a single molecule technique. So we are observing each individual DNA molecule, DNA polymerase molecule, on an individual basis, watching each molecule while it's synthesizing DNA, which is the ultimate limit of analytical chemistry in a way.
I suppose that makes it much faster than other sequencing methods, Jonas?
Yes, indeed. It is, from a chemistry point of view, about 30,000 times faster than the currently available technologies on the market.
Jonas, how does this technique differ from those other methods?
So one of the main differences is that we are observing the DNA polymerase activity in real time, and we are not interrupting the DNA synthesis activity. Other methods are used whereby a certain base in the sequence is being interrogated using DNA polymerase as a reagent, essentially. And then the system has to stop waiting for its interrogation of whether or not the base has been incorporated. Our technology is using the DNA polymerase in an uninterrupted fashion. We are eavesdropping on its activity in real time and essentially watching it continuously while it's polymerizing DNA. And that's one of the reasons why the overall sequencing speed is so much faster.
Steve, what hurdles did you and your team have to overcome to accomplish this direct observation of DNA polymerization?
Well, when my colleague Jonas brought this idea over, this was at Cornell University, he brought the idea over from the Webb group to the Craighead group. The hurdles we had to overcome were very clear. The first one is that DNA polymerases as a category are pretty greedy enzymes. They require high concentrations of these fluorescent labeled nucleotides in order to be fast, accurate, and processive. And at that time, the limitations on conventional microscopy were such that at the concentrations that you would need to keep the polymerase happy, you would have maybe thousands or tens of thousands of nucleotides in the observation volume at the same time as this single polymerase molecule. And of course, if we're going to treat the polymerase molecule as a sequencing machine, we have to look at it at the individual molecule basis, because if we tried to look at an ensemble, they would quickly grow out of phase with each other and the information would be garbled. So we had to overcome a significant problem right at the outset, which is we needed to make a three orders of magnitude improvement in the volume confinement capability of optical microscopy. And that was where we invented the zero-mode waveguide technology that was the subject of our 2003 science article. A second major hurdle that had to be overcome is figuring out how to attach the fluorophores to the nucleotides without disrupting the polymerase function. The conventional methods for attaching fluorophores to nucleotides call for it to be attached to the nucleobase. And as such, the fluorophore becomes a permanent part of the DNA double helix. And that's fine for substitution of 1 in 10 or 1 in 100 of the nucleotides in a DNA double helix. But for sequencing, you have to replace 100% of the nucleotides with their fluorescent labeled counterparts. And with base labeling, that's simply not possible, that the polymerization grinds to a halt after just a few bases of incorporation. So at Cornell, again, my colleague Jonas came up with this ingenious idea that by attaching the fluorophore, instead of to the nucleobase, to the terminal phosphate group on the nucleotide, that the polymerase in the natural course of catalysis would cut that bond between the alpha and beta phosphate linkage, leaving the last two, the pyrophosphate molecule, to diffuse away as a leaving group, a metabolic waste product of the reaction. By piggybacking our fluorophore on that leaving group, it's there during the rate-limiting steps of catalysis and conformational change, but then is spontaneously cleaved away from the reaction with 100% efficiency. And that leaves behind absolutely natural DNA synthesis product, which is unique. There's no other labeling technology that makes that possible. And that's very important for the maintenance of the speed, the accuracy, and the processivity.
In addition to what Steve said, additional hurdles were, one, the challenge of immobilizing single molecules in these three-dimensional zero-mode waveguide nanostructures Steve talked about. Such molecular placement and keeping all the polymerase molecules functional and active had really never been done before, and we were overcoming this challenge with novel surface chemistries and were able to form large arrays for high multiplex sequencing. And a fourth hurdle that I'd like to mention is the ability to detect the emission from single fluorophores as they are being used as labels in our DNA sequencing technology with high confidence. When we started this project, the field of single molecule and single fluorophore detection was really fledgling, and the first reports came out that this is indeed possible. And to transform it into something that's robust enough to enable large-scale DNA sequencing by this method required discoveries and innovation in the instrumentation that we built to make this work.
Well, how is the accuracy? You said it was 100% efficient. How accurate is it? Steve?
So in this paper, we demonstrated that with just 15 molecules, now these are templates 150 bases in length, that sequencing through just 15 individual molecules, that we were able to provide a perfect reconstruction of the sequence the majority of the time, so that the median accuracy in multiple iterations of sequencing through was 100%. And that means that we got 150 out of 150 of the bases correct.
What, if any, limitations are there for this technique?
Well, from an application standpoint, two of the parameters that the users of this technology care about a lot are the read length and the accuracy. Right now, the primary read length limitation relates to the photochemistry of excitation of fluorescent dye molecules in close proximity to these polymerase proteins. There's an interaction whereby an excited fluorophore can exchange an electron with amino acid side chains on the protein, which can then damage the polymerase. With regard to the accuracy, the two primary limiters in order of their importance are, one, missed bases, because of course nucleotide incorporation by polymerase is a thermodynamically driven process, so there's a degree of stochasticity, randomness in the process. And occasionally, a nucleotide can be incorporated faster than expected. And in those cases, you can wind up collecting fewer photons than are required in order to reliably detect it. The second most important source of error right now, is unproductive cognate binding. That means that a correctly base-paired nucleotide docks in the active site of the polymerase DNA complex, but for whatever reason, it's not incorporated, and it's torn free from the polymerase by thermodynamic fluctuations. In such a case, the system would register two pulses instead of one on the same color channel. So this we call sometimes stuttering.
So when do we see a machine?
We're going to be shipping a commercial version of this technology in 2010.
So does this method of DNA sequencing being faster mean that it will be more expensive, or will it make DNA sequencing both faster and less expensive because of the overall time save?
Well, of course, at introduction, I think you can expect that our DNA sequencing price will be competitive with the marketplace. But over time, this technique allows sequencing prices to drop to what we believe are going to be some kind of absolute floor. After all, the number of features on these chips can increase. Each zeromode waveguide is maintaining a separate and independent sequencing reaction that can be working on its own independent template. The reagent consumption is essentially nil. There's just one molecule used per base sequenced. That means that even sequencing an entire genome on a single chip, that there would be just nanograms of reagent consumed, and that with upwards of a million features on a single chip possible using today's technology in terms of manufacturing these zeromode waveguide chips, that would lead to a human genome sequence that would be consuming just one chip and using a negligible quantity of reagents. And because it's operating at multiple bases per second, the sequence would, even with fold coverage, require just about an hour.
In addition, the fact that the read lengths are projected to be longer than any of the currently existing technologies, downstream analysis costs are also going to be dramatically reduced as the assembly of the different individual sequencing reads into a fully finished human genome is going to be much simplified with these longer fragments.
Well, Jonas Korlach and Steve Turner, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Jonas Korlach and Steve Turner are two of the authors of a paper on real-time DNA sequencing from single polymerase molecules. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Also this week, the results of the 2009 AAAS Science Dance Your PhD contest are in. With a tango, modern dance solo, a mix of breakdance and ballet, and a folk dance-like piece, each of the four winners will now work with professional choreographers to develop their published research into a full-scale dance. The dances will debut at the AAAS annual meeting in Chicago in February 2009. For more on the dance contest, visit gonzolabs.org/dance. You can see the winning entries, danced by the scientists themselves, online at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. For decades, Wall Street has been attracting top physical sciences PhDs to become quantitative analysts, commonly known as quants. But with the economy in turmoil, is quantitative finance still a good career choice? To find out, Science Careers contributor Chelsea Wald went to New York University's Courant Institute of Mathematical Sciences to talk with Lee Macklin. Macklin is an instructor at Courant and a founding partner of Pragma Financial Systems.
Lee Macklin, thanks for being here. First, why don't you tell me, what are quants and what do they do?
Quants basically apply scientific method to solving Wall Street's math problems. And of course, with the increasing use of mathematics on Wall Street, they're very, very valuable. Increasingly, these skills are being put to use in practically every branch of finance. And without quants, there would be no modern Wall Street.
So how did you get into this career? What was your path?
I was a programmer who happened to be in the right place. I was always interested in finance, but wound up taking over more and more responsibility from my manager. And then, you know, there was a shakeup, and I found myself in one of those fortunate spots where I was running a quantitative trading department in a fairly well-known fund called Mint Investment Management. Mint was one of the early adopters of quantitative finance.
So what are some other routes into this profession, maybe some other typical routes?
You know, early on, there was a separation between the programmers, the researchers who had a business knowledge, and the mathematicians who were doing math. And basically what we've seen over the last 20 years or so is that those disciplines are being united in the Wall Street quant. Essentially, people coming from the physical sciences with a PhD or graduate degree in the physical sciences usually have a comfort with two of those, which is programming and mathematics. So the last piece would be the business knowledge, reading some of the papers that give them enough of a business background in finance to be able to apply the math and computing that they already know to financial problems.
And that leads to my next question. Should students interested in this kind of work take business courses as well as science and math courses? Should they consider getting MBAs?
I think MBAs are less useful than a master's in mathematical finance, like the program here at the Courant Institute. The master's in mathematical finance or master's in computational finance, which is another name for some of these programs that have more of a computing concentration, is a much more direct path to this objective.
So what kinds of companies hire quants?
Actually, it's the full range at this point. You know, it used to be that mathematical finance programs catered mostly to the sell side. So these are banks who are selling products to their clients. The buy side are hedge funds, pension managers, mutual fund managers, and they didn't use, or at least they didn't hire, the most sophisticated quants. They didn't use that mathematics until quite recently. And because that is an area that is really, really large and expanding, their use of mathematics has prompted us to include much more of a buy-side curriculum in our program.
What should that mean to someone entering or thinking of entering this profession?
Well, one, I think that the buy-side is much more open-ended and creative. You have a much broader range of talent that is going to be hired. And two, it means that all of the quants out there who have this hedge fund fantasy, now they can fulfill it. You know, the hedge funds are hiring high-level quants. It also means that the field itself is growing and has plenty of room to grow because the amount of money that's being managed there is, you know, larger than the banks and the sell-side institutions.
What kind of money can a quant expect to make starting out and then perhaps after 5 years?
It's probably a fraction of what they could, you know, expect to make before. But let me give you an example of, say, several years ago and then today. So several years ago, a quant coming out of a mathematical finance program would start at somewhere between 80K and 100K, and there would be a sizable bonus. You know, a typical bonus would be 25 to 40%. Today, I would think that, again, the difficulty is just getting in. The base salaries have not dropped so much, getting in probably 60, 70K, but then the bonus is going to be substantially lower, if there is one at all, this year. So this is sort of a bite the bullet kind of year. You know, the financial markets lead the economy as a whole. I mean, that's the job of markets, meaning they're predictors of the future, not, you know, the current conditions. And so actually, even though this is a very tough time to find a job on Wall Street, this is the right time to seek out the skills to find a job on Wall Street, meaning it will be the financial markets that recover first. So maybe this isn't a typical year. We're seeing a lot of turmoil, but the changes that are taking place that are basically replacing non-quantitative positions with quantitative positions, this is a trend that is going to only continue and perhaps even accelerate. If anything, the discipline of risk management is going to become more rigorous. It's going to require more math, and people are going to be more selective in who they hire. And over the years, this is still a very, very good choice for a profession.
So the last question is, quants have been blamed for at least part of the current crisis. What might be the morale effects of the blame that's being heaped on quants?
I can't say it's insignificant. I've, you know, talked to a bunch of former students who are feeling the effect of the deterioration of some of these departments. Some of them are actually considering leaving the field But I don't think that decision is a rational decision. That's based on, as you said, morale. In terms of how well does this business pay, what is its potential in the future, and all of that is positive. You know, if anything, you're going to see more growth out of this field and more use of math and computing. Wall Street is going to look to people who also have these skills to apply, you know, ever more rigorous standards to regulating and reining in the kind of quantitative trading that led to some of these blow-ups. So I don't see the role of the quant diminishing because of this. And I do expect that these markets are going to turn around first in finance. People are seeing these layoffs first in finance, and now you're seeing it on Main Street. So first on Wall Street, then on Main Street, and you're going to see hiring first on Wall Street as well. So this is a really good time to position for those roles.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was contributor Chelsea Wald speaking with Lee Macklin at NYU's Courant Institute of Mathematical Sciences in New York. You can read more about careers in quantitative analysis in a special package on careers in financial analysis in this week's Science and online at sciencecareers.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to be talking about decoding the woolly mammoth genome, the deep roots of the nuclear family, and finally, how bleach kills bacteria. It has something to do with unfolding proteins.
Well, let's start with decoding the woolly mammoth genome. This is an extinct species. Where do they find the DNA?
Well, Rob, surprisingly enough, they found the DNA on eBay.
eBay?
Yeah. Two researchers found somebody who was selling what they claimed was hair from a Siberian woolly mammoth on eBay. And the researchers went through a bunch of steps to verify that this actually was woolly mammoth hair. And when they did, they purchased it and they sequenced it. But it's not as easy as it sounds. Scientists have been trying to sequence ancient DNA for a long time now. They want to find out a lot of things about ancient species. What did they look like? Why did they go extinct? But it's been really hard. Even if they have the raw materials on hand to get this DNA, up until recently, the sequencing technology wasn't advanced enough to sequence a lot of this DNA, which tended to be very fragmentary. But that technology has improved over the last couple of years. And so with this hair on hand, the researchers were able to do a very nice job of sequencing about 70% of the woolly mammoth genome. And this is the largest amount of what's called nuclear DNA from an ancient creature that's ever been sequenced.
Nuclear DNA as opposed to
mitochondrial DNA. And actually, researchers before had sequenced mitochondrial DNA from the woolly mammoth. And this is the DNA, as you might expect, that lives in the mitochondria. But this only represents a small percentage of the total DNA of any animal. But the mitochondrial DNA that was sequenced a few years ago did provide a few clues. It suggested that woolly mammoths split off from elephants about 6 million years ago. It also suggested that there was two species of woolly mammoths living in Siberia, not just one.
What new thing were they able to tell with this nuclear DNA as opposed to the mitochondrial DNA?
Well, the problem with the mitochondrial DNA, as I said before, is that it only represents a very small proportion of the genome. And so to really be accurate about these things about, you know, when woolly mammoths split off from elephants and how they evolved, you really need a much larger percentage of the total DNA. And that's what they were able to do with this nuclear DNA from the hair they bought off eBay. And among the things they found was, first of all, they were able to confirm these findings from the mitochondrial DNA. But they also found a couple of other things. First of all, they found out that these two woolly mammoth species split from one ancestor species about 1.5 million years ago. But more importantly, they isolated a number of genetic mutations that were specific to the woolly mammoths. And these are important because they might shed light on, first of all, what made a woolly mammoth as opposed to an elephant, but also it may shed light on how these mammoths adapted to the really harsh environment they lived in Siberia. It was extremely cold there, for instance. And it might also indicate why the mammoths died off. Perhaps there was something in their genome that prevented them from adapting to climate change so that when the weather got warmer, they weren't able to survive.
What does this new sequencing ability mean for sequencing other extinct species?
Well, Rob, that's the other upshot of the study. The fact that these researchers were able to sequence so much of the woolly mammoth genome from a bunch of fragmented DNA suggests that whenever there is raw material sitting around from another extinct species, scientists may have a much easier time sequencing a large amount of its genome and making comparisons to modern-day animals.
Well, from the hair of extinct woolly mammoths to the deep roots of the nuclear family. Are we talking prehistoric here?
Yeah, we are. And in this case, scientists are trying to determine when the nuclear family got started. And Rob, when we talk about the nuclear family, we're talking about mom, dad, and a few kids, not the extended family or any other relatives. And there's been a lot of debate about when humans adopted the nuclear family. In most cultures around the world today, the nuclear family is the most prominent social unit.
Like tribes or clans or large extended families as the base unit.
Exactly. Scientists think that when humans just started out, and they take evidence from modern day hunter-gatherer societies, that the common unit wasn't the nuclear family, that it was something like you said, like a tribe or a clan or something like that. And they've been trying to figure out just when this transition happened, when we moved beyond this tribe lifestyle into more of a nuclear family lifestyle.
So what's the evidence then to go test these various positions?
Well, there has been evidence before now when archaeologists have dug up graves in a variety of ancient human sites. They found skeletons buried together that seemed to indicate perhaps that a nuclear family was buried together. But it's hard to make that assumption without having harder evidence than just sort of a bunch of skeletons together that suggest men and women and children. So in the new study, researchers looked at a site in Germany called Ilau, which was an early human farming site that goes back about 4,600 years. And they found two interesting graves there. One, they found a grave where an adult male and a female had been placed on their sides, face to face, arms intertwined with two boys. And in the other grave, they found an adult woman who was facing away from two girls and a boy. And this time, the team went further than other researchers had. They extracted mitochondrial and nuclear DNA samples from these bones, and they tested these samples, and they were able to show that in the first grave, the man and the woman were the parents of the two boys, which indicates what we would think of as a traditional nuclear family. And in the second grave, they were able to determine that the children were all related to each other. They were probably brothers and sisters. Now, the woman in that grave doesn't seem to have been the mother, but the researchers suspect she may have been an aunt or other close relative.
So this is the hard evidence that they were looking for and needed in order to establish the nuclear family as the optimal unit.
Exactly.
And the DNA they were able to recover is specific enough to do that?
Well, the team thinks it is, but one expert has raised the criticism that the markers that the team used, and these are markers that allow them to test how related individuals are to each other, are very widespread in Europe, which means they may not be specific enough to draw concrete conclusions about whether somebody is the brother or sister or the father of somebody else. So some experts are going to need more genetic testing in order to be fully convinced.
Well, from unfolding and extracting DNA from skeletons to the unfolding of proteins when bleach kills bacteria, that's what the acid inside bleach does, is unfold proteins?
Well, that's the question. And scientists are interested in answering this question because they want to develop better ways to kill bacteria, whether it be the bacteria on your countertop or even anthrax. But they want to be able to do so without all the toxicity that we associate with common household bleach. So the trick is finding out how bleach kills bacteria in the first place. And there's been a couple of theories. What we do know is that the active ingredient in bleach is called hypochlorous acid. And there were a couple of theories about how this might work. One theory went that the bleach somehow robbed the bacteria of electrons, which prevented the bugs from carrying out all of their metabolic processes.
Oxidation.
Right. And the other theory is that the acid somehow causes the proteins in bacteria to malfunction and therefore killing the bugs. And so in this new study, researchers looked at one of these proteins, which is called HSP33. And to their surprise, the bleach didn't disrupt this protein. In fact, it activated this protein.
What's this protein do?
Well, this protein belongs to a class of proteins called stress proteins, which protect cells against harsh stimuli such as excessive heat or acid. And past research has suggested that HSP33 protects cells by preventing other proteins from clumping if they unfold. And clumping is really bad because if you've got a bunch of proteins in a bacterial cell clumping together, then the cell can't function anymore and it dies. And the team tested this theory by adding a little bit of bleach to bacteria. And when only a little bit of bleach was added, the HSP33 activated and it protected the cell. And of course, when the researchers added a ton of bleach, the cells died. So it's not that HSP33 can totally protect the cells from bleach, but the fact that it's being activated when bleach is being added suggests that that's how bacteria are defending themselves, by preventing their proteins from clumping together. And therefore, that suggests that that's why bacteria are dying in the first place. Because if too much bleach is added, all their proteins clump together and they're essentially finished.
So the new disinfectant might be then something that just causes the proteins to clump together and doesn't necessarily have this hypochlorous acid in it.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about how researchers are developing a blood test for brain cancer, how ocean circulation is tied to climate change, and finally, a roach motel for bacteria. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the November 21st, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.